Good afternoon. We'll call the March 5th meeting of the Energy and Climate Committee to order. First order of business is the meeting minutes from February 27th. Representative Kraft, have you had a chance to look at the...
Madam Chair, I have. I move their approval.
Great. Let's see. All those in favor of approving the minutes from the 27th, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails and the meeting minutes are adopted. So we've got a couple of bills on the agenda today. First up is Representative Hollins in House File 3949, which is a geothermal energy system. And with that, Representative Hollins moves House File 3949 be laid over for possible inclusion. So welcome to committee. I guess, no, not welcome, but, yeah. Hi. It's Hello. Been a really long day, so I apologize. Go ahead, Representative Hollins, tell us about your bill.
Thank you. Thank you. Hello, everybody, chair, committee members. You basically took all of my talking points.
Was oh, good.
I wanted to motion to lay it over. But I would also let folks know that I'm very excited to be carrying this bill. I don't know if you know much about Sebanthony, but I do know that it was once the school where Prince went to school for a while, and so I was very excited about that alone. And I was asked to make some Prince references in my intro, but I'm not going to. I'm not going to play that game. So in the interest of time, I'm going to go ahead and introduce Scott Redd, the president and CEO of Sebanthony Community Center, and Janet Brown, who is the project consultant and development support for Sebanthony. And I'm going to turn it over to them to let them talk about the project.
Great. Welcome to committee. Go ahead and introduce yourselves and go ahead with your presentation.
Good afternoon, Chair Akins and committee members. My name is Scott Redd, and I'm president and CEO of Sebanthony Community Center. Thank you for taking the time today to hear about our bill and the Resilient Community Energy Project. Sebanthony Community Center is a 58-year-old African-American-founded nonprofit located in the heart of South Minneapolis. Our mission is to provide people of all ages and cultures with essential resources that inspire and improve their lives and to build a thriving community. In 1979, we were able to purchase this 188,000-square-foot building that sits on 5 acres of land, and that's nearly 100 years old right now. For decades, Sebanthony has been a critical institution to the South Minneapolis community. During the civil unrest after the murder of George Floyd, more than 700 buildings were damaged or destroyed. Our building remained untouched, not a piece of graffiti, not a broken window, and it's because of our relationship that we've had with the community, because we believe in partnering to do with the community and not to the community. Second slide, please, Jen. Sebanthony is a one-stop shop for integrated community services. We provide everything from workforce training, offer a large food shelf that assisted over 50,000 families in 2023, and we provide programming for youth through seniors in our community. We are also home to 28 mostly nonprofit organizations that operate out of our buildings, including a Montessori school and a health clinic. So each year, 150,000 people come through the doors of Sebanthony. 4 years ago, through a competitive process, the city of Minneapolis and Xcel chose Sebanthony as one of 3 locations as a Resilient Minneapolis project. The goal of the Resilient Minneapolis project was to establish 3 community hubs that could become non-wired power alternatives or centers isolated from the power grid so that in times of crisis, such as weather emergencies, sustained power outages, or natural disasters, the hubs would be able to operate as community emergency centers. Our objectives when entering this project were to create a safe, resilient hub to serve our 87% BIPOC community, reduce our emissions, create a living laboratory and workforce training opportunities that led to family sustaining careers and to reduce our energy costs. As I stated before, our building is nearly 100 years old and was incredibly inefficient when we started this project. Currently, Sebanthony heat is fueled from 2 giant natural gas boilers that we've named Thelma and Louise. Thelma and Louise are nearly 60 years old and on their last leg. You can see them here on the slide. This picture does not do the justice of how gigantic they are. One of the first things we did was to conduct an energy audit with Center for Energy and Environment. When we got the results of our audit back, we were rather surprised. Our Energy Star rating was a zero. We realized then we needed to develop a plan that would take us from worst to first. Over the last 3 years, we've installed LED lighting, 90 smart thermostats, and a new roof. During this time, we also saw an opportunity to engage the broader community and act as a living laboratory. We develop environmental sustainability career pathways in our workforce training programs, helping to expose community members to these fast-growing field. We have now completed all the low-hanging fruit. The remaining piece is the geothermal system, which is why we are here today. To achieve our goals and the goals of the Resilient Community Energy Project, we need to push Thelma and Louise over the cliff and transition this 100-year-old building infrastructure with a geothermal outdoor air system. Each year, we spend $20,000 in maintenance and pray that the boilers will survive another winter. By replacing the two gas boilers and 104 air conditionings with a direct outdoor air system, geothermal system, we will reduce our natural gas consumption by roughly 106,000 tons per year, or $61,000 per year. This is money we would prefer to spend helping community members move from striving to surviving, from surviving to thriving. We also will cut our emissions by 1,100 metric tons per year. I will also quickly mention we are in the process of building a new 72 multifamily low-income housing project on our campus. There will be enough heating and cooling capacity within the geothermal system to extend to the new housing unit and likely beyond into the community. Lastly, I want to thank all our partners who have worked with us over the last couple years. It has truly taken a village approach, and for that we are grateful. There's a lot more Janet and I can both say about this project, but in the interest of time, we wanted to keep it brief. We appreciate your time today and hope you will consider supporting our project this session, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that presentation, and there's so many good things that you had to say. I'm gonna turn it over to my colleagues if they have any questions. Is there anyone that, Ms. Brown, were you gonna provide anything or no?
No, thank you, Chair. I'm just here to answer questions afterwards, but I think we do have a couple other people testifying though.
Great, we have a couple of questions here quick before we open it up for, Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question to either bill author or the folks from the organization. what is the estimated lifespan that's left in the current furnaces?
Minus 10.
Oh. Legitimately, like
that's I'm sorry, I don't mean to be disrespectful. So, Chair and committee members, the current boiler system is well beyond its rate. We had one die last year. They cost about $20,000 to $30,000 a year just to get them up and running, but they have extended beyond their reasonable life, which was 50 years. They're about 68 years right now.
Thank you. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just what's the cost just to replace those with new natural gas?
Thank you for the question. We had a detailed engineering study that was done in 2021. It was about a 10-month-long study. We looked at 12 different systems, including just replacing a like-for-like system. It would be a steam boiler versus a hot water boiler, but the cost of that was $10,470,000. And one of the challenges that we have with this building is that, first of all, that there's so many steam traps throughout the building, about 214 steam traps. So those would have to be replaced. All the plumbing would have to be replaced. There's no currently fresh air system coming in, so we'd have to have a fresh air system. So the challenge is that even though there's an initial upfront cost for geothermal of $14.5 million, with the reduction annual cost savings of $60,000 for gas and also the investment tax credits of $4.7 million, it actually is a lower cost to install a geothermal system than it is to do a like-for-like replacement.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so let's just say thank you to the testifier. If you do not receive this money, how will you pay for the current system replacement?
Ms. Brown.
Yeah, thank you, Chair and committee. So we are currently still in the process of fundraising other efforts. So we currently, the entire project, the geothermal is $14.5 million. We also have battery backup storage, which Xcel Energy will speak to, a solar array, and other components. So we've raised close to a little over $6 million for the entire project. Mm-hmm. This is the last piece of it. We do have an EPA Community Challenge Grant that's outstanding right now. We hope to hear about that in the next couple months. That would provide $6 million in funding for this. We also have other funding through the city, state, county, I'm sorry, the city and the county, and just we're constantly pursuing other fundraising efforts. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. So it sounds like you've already got $6 million in the bank, and this is for a total project of, you say?
Ms. Brown.
14?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It sounds like those other funds are already in
total,
the pipeline?
I'm sorry, the total project is a little over $21 million. So.
Okay. Sounds good.
You're
good. And then, no, I appreciate that. And then just from a funding mechanism, just from a cost per, you know, the Renewable Development Fund is not, this isn't necessarily, you know, this is all ratepayer money, so these are people that are paying extra high bills to put money into these accounts. Just from an efficiency standpoint, if we're truly looking to, reduce carbon, how does this compare to other projects? If we were just to build some solar or some wind someplace out in the country, like comparatively from a cost benefit analysis, have you guys looked into that at all? Or
yeah, thank you for Madam Chair and committee. So we have been working closely with the Department of Energy and National Renewable Energy Lab in Colorado for the last almost 2 years on providing some data from their REOP system. So looking at all of those different scenarios, what would the battery size be? What would a solar array be? What would be the reduction in carbon emissions? The estimates that they've given is that based on the battery storage size and the geothermal system, it would be, first of all, reducing about 1,100 metric tons of carbon a year. That's like taking 275 cars off the road. It would reduce health impacts by $763,000 a year over the 25 years of the project. So it would be more than just reducing the over, you know, certainly we want to make sure that the cost is reduced for Sabathany, which pays exorbitant energy costs. I just saw the bill that went out yesterday for natural gas was $11,750 for the month of February. Mm-hmm. And that was a mild month.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that would just be my final question. Just, you know, I appreciate the work that you're doing in the community and whatnot, but, you know, this is a real cost to ratepayers. Ratepayers are paying a higher cost on their electric to fund projects like this. You know, would, as part of the negotiations at whether or not this project would be to move forward, would you consider it as an organization that 60, or it would be actually 80,000, so it would be 60,000 fuel costs plus the 20,000 of money that you would save, so about $80,000 a month. Would you consider that as take that savings that you're, if this were to go in, and pay that back to ratepayers to kind of make it like a short-term loan or anything like that? Would the organization be open to anything like that to ease the burden of high electric costs in Minnesota?
Well, thank
Ms.
you.
Ms. Brown, I will just say, maybe I don't think that we're negotiating at the table here, but I'll certainly give you an opportunity to answer the question. Go ahead.
Yeah, and support.
Yeah, I think the last point on that I just would like to make is that this is an organization that's been serving its community for 58 years and is in a community that is highly redlined, has been concentrated pollution, has been underinvested in. Last year, during the storm in Houston, this is an organization that had to pay $11,000 for fuel costs in Houston. So a black organization is paying for the mistakes of done in Texas. So I don't think this is an organization that has not paid its community benefits. So I'll just leave it at that.
And I believe Representative Hollins looks like you'd like to add something.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Swazinski. So one thing I will point out is Sebanthony is located in XL territory, so it is in fact those community members that have been paying into this and have been ratepayers for a long time now. And so when we think about the benefits of moving them to geothermal, so not only is it the ratepayers that literally live in this complex and that are served by this community center, but it's also all of the surrounding individuals in the city of Minneapolis who are going to be benefiting from a reduced emissions that would come from the geothermal. So I actually do think this fits very squarely into what the RDA funds were designed for, and I just want to leave it at that. Thanks.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Eloff, I just want to make sure that in the bill we're referencing the renewable development account, that this is the fund that the dry cask is funded by, the dry cask storage fees. It's not like a, it's not an auxiliary fund or something else.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, this is the RDA fund.
Okay. All right. So in
Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair, I don't think Mr. Eloff does the finance accounts, but what is the balance of the RDA right now?
Good question. Do we have that?
Or perhaps someone will whisper it in his ear and he'll have it memorized. Is that...
Or Ashley can say it.
One moment.
The number I'm getting from Mr. Molzon is $14.2 million.
That's the end biennium balance.
And so of the remaining $14.2 million, this project would take $10 million of that?
I think the bill says six this year and four next, so it would be that would be in a next biennium.
No, that'd be the same biennium. Four, 24 and 25 are the same biennium.
Thank you for that correction.
Yep. So, and Madam Chair, just a last question for our nonpartisan staff: what are the dry cask fees for a year? That should be on the spreadsheet, the revenue listing. I know every time a new cask is added at Monticello or Prairie Island, the fees go up. What's for fiscal year 24, fiscal year 25, what are the, do you have a revenue numbers for those?
Yeah, the revenues, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo. The revenue for fiscal year 24 is $28.7 million, and then the revenue for fiscal year 25 is $23.9
million. Okay, so. Madam Chair, so
Representative Garofalo.
For the biennium, dry cask fees are about $52 million. This one project would take 20% of the statewide Excel service territory dry cask contribution fees. This one project would take that amount, which seems certainly it's no commentary on the work that's being done or the need that needs to be done, but that's a very large ask for a limited-sized fund. So thank you.
And last question before we open for the public testimony is Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question within the design of the system that you're going to be putting in. It says on your handout that you're replacing the two boilers and 104 air conditioners with geothermal direct outdoor air system. What temperatures, exterior temperatures, can that operate down to?
Ms. Brown or Mr. Britt.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. The heat pumps that are operating are insulated, and so we've been told that it can operate down to a minus 20. We are actually in the design phase, though, considering this project is also part of the Natural Gas Innovation Act with CenterPoint Energy, and so we are looking at a small gas boiler as a backup for those coldest days, and we'll determine whether we end up, you know, that's actually being considered as part of the project right now.
Representative Mecklen, do you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the intent would be to have some kind of backup in the event. I do have a heat pump, and they told me 20, but it's right around 2 below when it kicks off. And so it's imperative that we understand our climate. I mean, this year was pretty favorable, but this last winter. But to that point, that there does have to be a backup heat source. That's all I had, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, with that, we will open up. There's a couple people signed up for public testimony. Anna Johnson with Fresh Energy.
Good
Welcome to committee. Ms. Johnson, please state your name for the record.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Anna Johnson. I'm the Senior Manager of State and Local Affairs at Fresh Energy. Fresh Energy is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization based here in Minnesota. For the past 30 years, we've been advocating for policies to achieve an equitable carbon neutral economy, and we appreciate the opportunity to testify on House File 3949. As you've heard, Sabathany Community Center has been a pillar of South Minneapolis since 1966 and continues to provide essential services to this community. As a resident of South Minneapolis, I'm personally grateful for all you do. And if you've been to Sabathany, you know it is a community hub there, where there's always a lot going on. Minnesota has made great strides in decarbonizing the electric sector, and as of 2023, we're on a path to 100% carbon-free electricity by 2040. Now, to avoid the worst impacts of climate change, we must turn our attention to other sectors of the economy, like buildings. The funding in this bill would provide critical support for the installation of a district energy geothermal heat pump system. Systems that rely on energy stored in the ground and are powered by clean electricity can be multiple times more efficient than the most efficient gas furnace or electric resistance heater, especially in cold climates like Minnesota. We believe that the geothermal energy systems like the one proposed for Sabathany represent a cost-effective, scalable solution to help meet our emissions reduction goals, improve public health, and improve community resiliency while providing equitable and reliable heating and cooling to Minnesota's buildings. This project is an innovative energy, efficient energy investment in line with the statutory goals of the renewable development account, and providing these funds is critical for seeing the project to fruition. It will enable Sabathany to continue to serve as a cornerstone of their community. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I hope you'll support this project.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Next up, we have Nick Martin with Xcel Energy. Welcome to committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon. Nick Martin, Director of Strategic Outreach and Advocacy for Xcel Energy. Thank you, Chair Aikam and members of the committee, for the opportunity to be here today and convey our support for House File 3949. Just a little history. Xcel has been working with Sabathany quite closely since about 2020. The core of our partnership, which was already mentioned today, is creating a resilience hub for the surrounding community. Sabathany has for decades been a real center of gravity for this neighborhood, and the 150,000 people that come through Sabathany's doors each year are also Xcel Energy customers, community members that we care deeply about, and many of them are disproportionately vulnerable in an emergency due to decades of systemic inequities in wealth, health, home ownership, and other areas. One part of our partnership with Sabathany focuses on creating a solar battery microgrid at Sabathany. This is separate from the geothermal project we've been discussing. Sabathany is one of three sites for the Resilient Minneapolis project. So this microgrid would enable Sabathany to serve as a safe gathering space in if an emergency were to knock out power. Sabathany would continue to have power for critical services like heating, cooling, food, refrigeration of medicines, phone charging, and so on. Sabathany's community energy vision, though, that Mr. Red talked about is bigger than that. It's not only about what happens in an outage, which thankfully are quite rare on Xcel's system. It's about strengthening the community economically, reducing emissions, helping people save money on energy, and connecting them to new career opportunities in the clean energy field. Those are all key priorities for Xcel also. The centerpiece of Sabathany's vision is really to stabilize Sabathany's energy future by converting from these costly to maintain natural gas boilers to a state-of-the-art geothermal heat pump system. That system would at first serve Sabathany, but over time could be expanded into a network system to serve affordable housing that Sabathany is working on site and other buildings in the neighborhood. So to us, that as a gas utility ourselves, that's a really interesting example of networked geothermal and electrification of heating, which is a key part of Xcel's own ambition to become a net zero natural gas provider by 2050. We acknowledge the upfront investment here is pretty significant, and it can't be funded entirely through existing programs. There's significant private funding going toward the overall project. Xcel is making a big investment in the microgrid part of this community energy vision. We do think the RDA, we know it's important to be really cognizant of how that money is spent. That money does come from our customers, but every year the legislature makes decisions around how to use it. We think this is an appropriate use of that money. Fits very squarely within the eligible purpose around innovative energy projects that reduce demand and increase system efficiency and flexibility. And so if the legislature sees fit to support this project with RDA funds, Xcel would continue to support in other ways, including through our Energy Conservation and Optimization Act rebates and working with CenterPoint to provide support on the natural gas side. So thanks very much. Appreciate the chance, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Is there anyone else from the audience who wants to testify on this bill today? Seeing none, I open up for comments or questions by my colleagues here. I certainly I appreciate the geothermal aspect of this and the potential for network geothermal. That's certainly, I think, an important path forward to decarbonize the heating and cooling of our buildings. So I appreciate that you guys are doing that, or that's a part of this project. And in the introduction, I think you talked about there being other community hubs like this one. Are they also moving forward? And I know that's not what we're here talking about today, but where are they located throughout the metro, if that is the case? Mr. Red.
Cherry comes North Minneapolis Renewable Energy Partners, and then the American Indian Center in South Minneapolis,
nice,
off of Franklin.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I was just, I looked up your 990. I think this is your organization, and I'm just wondering if you could let me know what your net revenue was for 2021. Do you happen to know?
We actually have our CFO here.
Would you like to come up to the, excuse me, sir, can you come up to the microphone and introduce yourself for the record, please?
Yes, I'm Jamel Duncan. I'm the CFO at Sabethany Community Center, and I believe it was $1.5 million. I wasn't there in 21, but I believe that's what it was.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm pretty sure total revenue, line 12, for 2021 was $2.6 million, and prior year was $2.5 million. The only reason I ask is because if your total revenue was a quarter of the ask, that's a big ask. I'm not quite sure how you would replace your infrastructure with the total revenue in 2020, unless you've like increased your revenue tremendously since 2021. But 2020 was 2.5, 21 was 2.6 million. And if you're going to try to replace infrastructure for 10 million plus, I'm not sure how that works. So maybe in 22 you had a much, that 20, the IRS only has through 21. That's what they have listed. So I'm just wondering if you have.
So our budget for 2024 is $4 million that was approved by the board. We've increased a lot of programming that we didn't have in the past. Due to COVID, they lost a lot of programming. And so right now we're increasing programming and things at Sabethany. Creating Environment and Sustainability Academy and other things. We're looking at constantly trying to increase programming to provide the needs for the community that they're asking us for services. So we're getting more funding from Hennepin County. Right now we have about four or five contracts with Hennepin County. Before they only had one. And so we're constantly applying for money to increase programming at Sabethany.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I've worked for many nonprofits throughout my time. I'm currently working for another one, and this is a big ask for an organization that hopes to have $4 million. That this is a really big ask, just to put it in perspective. But my question to you, Madam Chair, is I don't recall us doing, at least before your tenure here, doing RDA money to nonprofits. I'm wondering if nonpartisan staff maybe has any history of us doing anything even remotely close to this. And maybe in this last, you know, in 2023 we did some nonprofits. I'm not sure. I don't have that document in front of me, but I'm wondering if nonpartisan staff have possibly, if we've done this before, is this a new thing we're doing in this biennium?
Mr. Ela.
Madam Chair, Representative Rarick, Nothing comes to mind off the top of my head, but you've given us something to do some research on, and we could check that out.
Representative Rare.
Thank you. So in my recollection, and I think the researcher is accurate, we haven't done this sort of thing. And, I mean, at its heart, this is more like HEPR to a nonprofit. And, yes, it could be saving some energy. It could be saving some pollution to the local community. But this is a really big ask for an organization that's a quarter of that. That's their revenue is, you know, as of 2021 was a quarter of this ask. So I have concerns as someone that actually is a ED for a nonprofit. I have concerns. That's an awful lot of money to ask for. And if your gross revenue is on line 12 of the 990 for 2021 was 2.5 million.
Did you have a response, Mr. Redd?
Yes, thank you. I appreciate that, Madam Chair. What I would say is that for far too long, BIPOC communities and organizations like Sabathany have not been invested in. And I say that coming from a place like AON, which I served as the chief operating officer, and I look at the money that was afforded to organizations like that, and when I look at especially these black organizations that serve 150,000 people through our mission and the lack of investment that has been given to that has been afforded to those organizations. We don't have a large a grant writing team. We don't have a large development team. We don't have a development team, actually. So we're doing these things to make that happen. And to consider that we are serving 150,000 people and we're doing it on our mostly on our own dime is pretty incredible. And the fact that this organization, without much state support, can stay in business for as long as we have been, and that this is one of the first times that we're at this forum asking for assistance, we completed the community needs assessment, and it shows that our community believes in us. And they want this to happen. So what I would say is, what would happen to those 150,000 people that we serve if Sabathany was to disappear? When I first came on as the CEO of Sabathany, my phone rang every week from developers asking to buy that building because what you just stated, because of the underinvestment there. They wanted us to sell that building. But because of the four founders, the black founders that started from Sabathany Church that we couldn't let that happen, and because of the 150,000 people that come through those doors a year, without the support, that we haven't received much support from the state. But those things are changing. Hennepin County is believing in us. Folks like Excel is sharing in that partnership. So I would ask that question, what would happen if Sabathany was to disappear? What would happen if to those 50,000 families that needed our support for food? What would happen to the 302 people that we helped find careers? Not jobs, careers, family sustainable wages. What would happen? What would happen to the 48 units of affordable housing that we have for our seniors? And that's more of the question. So I think that's something that I would like to pose to this group as well.
Thank you, Mr. Redd. And yep. As I think and sit back over my time on this committee, we've certainly invested RDA money in St. Thomas to do a microgrid. We've invested in private companies like Helene for solar panel development. And so I think that the benefits that Mr. Redd just described certainly make it a valuable asset to the community. But any final words, Representative Holland? Go ahead, Representative Rare.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to that point, just really quickly, and I'll let them wrap. So in the 2021, again, the most recent 990, it also shows that government grants received was 1.4 million, again, of that 2.5. So, and their other contributions, gifts, grants, was 731. So again, I would say this is 10 million is a big ask in relation to that.
Thank you, Representative Altendorf.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure, the question might actually be to you or to the Excel testifier that was up here. But my question is, you know, as a committee, because in 2023 we passed the 2040 carbon-free energy bill. Mm-hmm. So we are looking at the RDA, which was just testified, 28.7 million, and then the next year, 23.9 million, I think, if I can see my numbers. So what I'm wondering as a committee, and like I said, I'm sorry, I don't know who I'm directing this question to, but have we done some sort of cost analysis of where those dollars are being spent to get us to this big energy goal that was already passed? And what projects are going to that, which is going to get us to that goal? Has there been an analysis done that is showing where, you know, like where we're putting the dollars that we have accessible to get us to the 2040 goal? Is there some sort of analysis on these dollars so that we're doing the very best to, you know, reach that plan?
There isn't an analysis that I know of. What I will say is that the dollars in the RDA are never going to be sufficient to achieve the 100% goals, and so they are going to be tools that we can use to help get us there. Did you have any follow-up question?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I just think as the Energy Committee, I mean, this is, I don't think this is a naive question. I mean, I think this should be expected of us, of the taxpayers of the state of Minnesota and the ratepayers to Xcel Energy, and that we are putting our dollars where they're going to have the biggest impact. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kraft?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's more of a comment. I appreciate Representative Rarick's point that this is a unique request. It's a sizable request. It's something I think we have to, out of the ordinary, something we have to carefully consider. But I also really want to appreciate Mr. Red's focusing of our thought process on this, because I disagree with the analysis that because of the size of your budget that you're able to pull together, that is the determining factor of this type of what you're asking. I think it's more about what is the impact that you're having and the number of folks that you are serving. I think when you're talking about, and especially in a community that has been underserved and underinvested in, so if we're going to apply this, how much is the size of your budget in a situation like you're in? I think it's a faulty premise. So again, I think it's a unique request. I think we have to carefully consider it, but I really appreciate you focusing us on things that I think matter.
Any closing remarks, Representative Hollins?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Committee. I appreciate the conversation that we're having here today. I do acknowledge it is a large ask, but as you heard, I mean, there has been detailed examination of what alternatives would cost as well. And I think they've really done their due diligence. They've worked really hard to raise additional funds to help cover some of the costs of this program. And I do think this is, to Representative Kraft's point, a deserving community that is actually doing the work. And in fact, when I look at what the budget of an organization is, to me, an organization that would have a larger budget, I would say, why are you coming to us asking for money? You have a big budget, like go handle your stuff. But when we're talking about communities that are really working with disadvantaged individuals and historically unrepresented individuals, it makes a lot of sense that we as a state and as entities like Xcel can come together and help to support them in something that's not only gonna benefit the folks who actually utilize Sebanthony, but also the surrounding communities as well. So I would encourage your support. Thank you.
With that, Representative Holland renews her motion that House File 3949 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over. And next on our agenda today, we have House File 3900. Representative Kraft is making his way to the table. And while he's getting settled, I'll move Representative Kraft moves House File 3900 be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation. And it looks as though, Representative, you have an A1 amendment. Would you like to move the A1?
Yes, I would like. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the A1 amendment. It gets the bill in the shape that I would like to discuss it, and I'll describe it when I get to that discussion.
Okay, great. Any discussion to the A1? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed say nay. The motion passes and the amendment is adopted. So, Representative Kraft, will you please tell us about your bill as amended?
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. So, as I spoke about last week, with the increase in renewable energy, electric vehicles, building electrification, our grid will need to carry a lot more electricity. The backbone or superhighways of the grid are high voltage transmission lines, and we need more of them. The process of building them can take 5 to 10 years and can be loosely divided into figuring out where they go or siting, permitting, and implementation. So this is the third of three grid-related bills I'm presenting to this committee. My grid-enhancing technologies bill, HF 3704, last week was about making better use of our existing transmission assets while we build more. The agency response time bill, or HF 3457, was about making part of the permitting process shorter and more deterministic. And this bill is about siting. The concept in this bill is quite simple. Where the state has existing corridors used for major roads, when it makes sense, why not use the same corridors for transmission lines? The benefit is that a transmission owner can deal with one entity rather than what can be hundreds of landowners, saving money and time. And even when right-of-way along a major road might not be wide enough for a transmission line and its overhang, it still can be a benefit because then a transmission owner only has to ask landowners next to right-of-way to overhang their property versus going through it. An example from Wisconsin, one of three states that have laws prioritizing transmission co-location with major highway right-of-way, shows the potential benefits. The Badger Cooley transmission line was completed in 2018, is 180 miles long, with 100 miles sited and permitted in Wisconsin DOT right-of-way along Interstate 90-94. The project was announced in 2010, applications were submitted in 23, and construction began in 2016. The 100 miles of highway right-of-way used for this project resulted in probably 300 to 400 private landowners not being impacted. So, specifics of the bill, it does two main things. One, and this is the amendment, really makes it clear that MnDOT needs to allow co-location subject to public safety considerations in their right-of-way. And secondly, describes how costs will be dealt with. This is from Section 1, Subdivision 2 of the bill. If MnDOT has to move co-located infrastructure due to needed highway expansions or changes. So I will point out that there is still work going on in this area of the bill and with stakeholders involved. So the specifics here might change at its next committee stop, which is transportation. And with that, I can have public testimony or comment or questions, whatever you'd like.
I think any questions from members really quick. Representative Rep. Mecklen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for clarification, so if due to a highway construction project, would this, and if they're asking or requesting that the voltage lines be moved due to new construction, would this now eliminate them from capturing the cost because they were told they had to move a line? I guess I just want to make sure if I'm understanding this right.
Representative Kraft.
Madam Chair, Representative Mecklen. So in the language here, what it says is going forward, the utilities would pay for the relocation cost, right? That to date on interstates, MnDOT pays for the relocation cost. That portion of this is still under negotiation and so may evolve before its next committee stop.
Madam Chair, just a little bit more clarification. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess what I'm trying to get to is if the highway department or whichever road entity is requesting that they move their lines that are currently existing, would they lose the ability to be reimbursed for the cost of relocating at the demand of, say, the Department of Transportation?
Representative Kraft.
Madam Chair, I'm going to try. I might not be fully following. The language in here is about, that's in there, is about new facilities being constructed. It doesn't change the situation on existing facilities.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Great. Next, Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. Okay, so for my question would be with then you are, just if you could verify, you are transferring the cost is to the co-ops or to the utility, just to clarify that first.
Representative Kraft.
Madam Chair, Representative Altendorf, transferring the cost, can you be more, I'm not sure, transferring the cost.
Moving the.
Representative Altendorf.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, you're good.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, yeah, when they're relocating the transmission lines. So right now, MnDOT pays for it, or the Trunk Highway Fund, and now the new, it'll, the cost is going to be basically charged to the utility company of that area?
Representative Kraft.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Altendorf. The language in that's in the bill right now, as I said, which is under negotiation still with stakeholders, but what it says is that on interstate right-of-way, that if changes happen in the future, that it would be renewed would be responsibility of the utilities.
And then I will also maybe just add that there's also a cost savings to the utilities to use the right-of-way instead of having to establish easements on private property. So it can be a big cost savings, and so this is the other side of that. Go ahead, Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. So out in the rural areas, you know, like where I am, I mean, you could go a half mile, you could go a mile, you could have one property. And so like with a co-op, a utility company, they don't have a lot of people in the same amount of distance that's paying in these costs. So by transferring the cost to the utility company, especially in our rural districts, you know, it could be costs that are just literally not sustainable. I don't know if we're looking at it from that perspective. You know what I'm saying? Like, so if you did a mile in a more metro area, you would have, and again, I mean, I haven't looked into this, so I don't have the numbers, but you could possibly have hundreds of ratepayers that are paying into this area that's moving. Out in a rural community, you could have a mile of transmission that is very, very small number of people. And so I'm not sure I would say that this does need to be looked at differently, because I don't know if in rural areas that the utility companies could support handling this cost, because they just do not have the same number of people per mile.
Representative Kraft.
Madam Chair, Representative Altendorf, thank you for the input. I'll take that into consideration.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to Representative Kraft, just kind of looking at just that portion, when it comes to, so Minnesota under current law isn't currently utilizing some of these areas for right-of-way, that this law needs to change?
Representative Kraft.
Madam Chair, we're not using it, but Representative Swazinski, no, we're not using it nearly to the same extent as like our neighbor has done quite effectively.
Representative Swazinski, did you have some follow-up?
Yes, I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. So we're currently not using it. Are you proposing that that these utilities use these as a preferred route to move electricity into the metro area?
Representative Kraft.
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, this is about moving electricity, period, and no, it's not a preferred option. It opens up this as a option that they can use in a easier and more effective way.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so just from a general, you know, contracting, so if we're looking at, let's say the sheet of paper here, Representative Kraft, would be considered the right-of-way, but the utility line that's used doesn't necessarily travel on it, but just next to it, so like just outside of those bounds, would this bill and the changes and the cost shifting from utility from the state when they potentially need to move those lines, that cost currently is borne by taxpayers, but it would be shifted to ratepayers only if those lines run on the proverbial paper, not next to it? Or does that change it? Because essentially what you're saying is, like, if the lines run just on the outside of that current right-of-way, let's say there's a widening project, which is probably 9 times out of 10 what we're talking about, and those lines of right-of-way move now into where those lines would be captured, under those circumstances, when the line itself moves, or the lines of the right-of-way move, is that the opportunity where those would no longer be paid for by the state, or is it only if they're actually on current lines?
Now, before I pass it over to Representative Kraft, it might be that some of our testifiers can clear up some of these questions, and so I don't
she
know.
She looks if like it she's ready to go.
Might be better to turn to our testifiers and continue with questions afterwards. So,
yeah, I'm fine with that.
Representative Kraft, do you want to comment?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Suska. I'll make one comment, and then I do think it'd be better to have the testifiers come through. This bill doesn't address a situation where things are not in MnDOT right-of-way today.
And so I think there are several people signed up for public testimony, first of which is Madeline Smarillo. Help me out, please. I'm sorry, from Clean Grid.
Madeline Smarillo.
Smarillo.
Constituent of Chair Acomb.
Oh!
Wow! One of 45,000.
Smarillo. Okay, that one will be etched. Etched.
Nice.
Well played. Ms. Smarillo, please proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for having me back to discuss this important bill that has to do with transmission. You may remember me from last week. I was here talking about grid-enhancing technologies. I work with Clean Grid Alliance, a regional nonprofit. We're based in St. Paul, and it's our focus to ensure that the grid is ready and prepared to take on the renewable energy that we are bringing onto the grid and to make a good business environment for our members who are primarily renewable energy developers and other NGOs. So I want to address general feelings about the bill, and then I'll make a couple of notes based on some things I heard that might offer some clarification. So Minnesota, as you know, has insufficient transmission capacity to meet our ongoing and changing electrification needs. And this contributes to expensive congestion, which we were talking about last week when we talked about grid-enhancing technologies. We need more transmission to enable the thousands of megawatts that we're going to need to meet our 2040 carbon-free goals, as well as to just continue to deliver reliable and affordable electricity to our customers as we decarbonize. CGA has heard from developer members as well as utility regulators across the Midwest that access to all types of highway rights-of-way for transmission line development is helpful in routing processes. In a time when Minnesota is pursuing ambitious carbon reduction and electrification goals, we need to use all available resources to comply with the standards that we've set. This is an all-hands-on-deck effort. Legislators, utilities, and regulators, industry and labor, NGOs, and notably state agencies need to participate. We've established that it is the policy of the state to reach 100% carbon-free electricity by 2040. Transmission is essential to getting us there reliably and affordably. The more efficiently and effectively we can build out transmission without taking away from our thorough public input and environmental review processes, the better. So this bill strikes a balance between allowing us to develop transmission more efficiently while not taking away from our public input process. In fact, theoretically, it should be a really positive thing for private landowners that would normally be affected by transmission line development to see more of our existing infrastructure, or rather existing corridors, being used. So it is an opportunity for utilities to look at all their options. And I think to answer some of the questions that we're asking about what's currently happening, as Representative Swodzinski, thank you, had mentioned, we currently frequently see transmission being developed next to highway rights of way. And my understanding of the language in the bill, at least on the relocation reimbursement provision, while Representative Kraft had stated it is under the works and maybe changed, et cetera, as currently written, it would only impact projects that are not yet built and are being built after July 1st of 2024. And it wouldn't matter if they were in the right-of-way or not in the right-of-way, if they needed to be, if they were seeking reimbursement for relocation, regardless of where they were permitted, as long as they have a permit, they would no longer be eligible under the current language. So that's something I wanted to address. But thank you for having me in committee today. I really appreciate the time. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Merlo. Next on the list, we have Kayla Christensen with the Minnesota Conservative Energy Forum. I'm having a hard time talking today. Welcome to committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Yes, my name is Kayla Christensen, Executive Director of the Minnesota Conservative Energy Forum. Chair Acomb and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. And thank you to Representative Kraft for bringing forward this bill. The Minnesota Conservative Energy Forum is a nonprofit education and advocacy organization that promotes a market-based all-of-the-above energy strategy for Minnesota. I'm pleased to be here today to share MNCEF's support for House File 3900 as amended. As more projects are being built and new innovations in energy come to market, and especially with the legislature's 100% carbon free by 2040 mandate, we will need to significantly increase our transmission capacity. This will be a challenge as it is much more difficult to secure landowner agreements for transmission lines because landowners typically only get a one-time payment as opposed to the long-term leases for wind or solar. This legislation would help alleviate much of the heartburn around these projects. You may hear opponents say that transmission lines aren't actually needed. Rather, the only reason they're being built is because of renewables and these mandates, when in reality, we have been 15 years behind on transmission before the 100% and it was enacted last legislative session. MNCEF's field program, the Minnesota Land and Liberty Coalition, serves as a resource and provides education across the state to the public and local policymakers, often in areas where utility-scale renewable projects are being proposed. We are able to hear directly from people most affected by these projects. And while some oppose the actual wind turbines or solar panels, if a project has transmission line included, that is where we often hear the most questions and concerns. The leading questions are, number one, why can't you bury the lines? And number two, why can't you put them along the current transportation corridors where there's room for this kind of infrastructure? The answer to the first question, as we all know, is it's extremely expensive to bury high-voltage transmission lines, and they are much more difficult to repair. But the answer to the second is something we've been seeking for a number of years. Landowners are often aware of our transmission needs, but the land along transportation corridors already developed to serve the public are not able to be used for co-location. Instead, they see developers seeking private land by agreement, and in some cases with utilities using eminent domain to site transmission. Your constituents are asking for this. Yesterday, MISO released its preliminary plans for Tranche 2, and this project would be a great candidate to take advantage of this policy. Landowners along these routes can have confidence that all the best route will be examined and the corridors will be available to alleviate some of the lines. And utilities will have a process by which they can seek co-location where prudent and in transportation corridors. This legislation provides the opportunity to maximize utilization of existing resources, prioritize expediency, minimize cost of acquiring land, and protect private property rights while still ensuring the highest standards of safety. This bill isn't just something that only industry group wants. We hear from your constituents on a weekly basis on why can't we put them along the interstate corridor. This is creating another tool to use during project planning, giving the PUC, utilities, developers, and communities flexibility. We urge your support on House File 3900 as amended.
Thank you, Ms. Christensen. Next up, we have Mike Bull with Elite in Minnesota Power. I'm pretty sure he's not my constituent. Welcome to committee. That's true. You never know. Welcome to committee.
That honor goes to Representative Garofalo.
And Madam Chair, I know how to pronounce my constituents.
Garofa what? Mr. Ball, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am Mike Bolt, Senior Policy Advisor to the Elite family of energy businesses, excuse me, including Minnesota Power, the public utility that provides reliable and affordable electric service to residents and businesses across northeastern Minnesota. And today, Minnesota Power is the most renewable public utility in the state, providing customers with electricity that's nearly 60% renewable. We appreciate the opportunity to provide brief comments on House File 3900. And I'd hope to be able to support the bill like we did in the Senate yesterday. But unfortunately, this draft of the legislation won't really change whether utilities site high voltage transmission lines in the federal rights of way controlled by MnDOT. Under current MnDOT policy, they will not allow transmission lines to be constructed in those rights of way because they bear the risk, the cost risk, if they decide later to relocate those lines. Under this draft of the legislation, that unbounded cost risk is shifted from being spread out statewide to being concentrated, as we've discussed in Q&A, concentrated on the customers of a particular utility. And I don't know that any utility would accept that unbounded cost risk. We'll make the same rational choice that MnDOT makes currently. Taking a step back, though, I think, you know, last session you required Minnesota Electric Utilities to take on the Herculean task of providing 100% carbon-free electricity to Minnesotans within 16 short years. And I'd ask you to look at every piece of legislation that affects Minnesota electric utilities this session and in the sessions to come and ask yourselves, does this help Minnesota reach that very difficult requirement? And unfortunately, as the bill stands today, this will not help us reach 100% by 2040, though it's very well intentioned, and we're happy to hear that that the authors are still open to discussion and negotiation about how this bill should be constructed. We're happy to commit to continuing to work with Representative Kraft, the Next Gen Highway Coalition, MnDOT, and other interested parties on the bill as the session progresses. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Bull. And last up for public testimony, we have Aurora Vatran from the 100% campaign. Welcome to committee. Please go ahead and state your name and proceed.
Chair Aiko, members of the committee, my name is Aurora Vatran, and I'm the legislative director for 100%. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and thank you, Representative Kraft, for your leadership on this bill. A little over a year ago, this body passed nation-leading legislation to get Minnesota to 100% clean electricity by 2040, making a promise to Minnesotans to do everything possible to decarbonize our electricity sector as long as it is safe, reliable, and affordable. The Next Generation Highway Act is a common-sense, strategic, and well-placed piece of the puzzle to keep our word to Minnesotans. We know that in order to meet our goals, we have work to do to build the transmission lines necessary to connect our clean energy from where it's generated to the people and places that need it. But we'll need to do more than that. We're going to need highways to function as multifaceted public infrastructure. We'll need them to be safe and reliable for drivers, of course, but they're also an ideal place for transmission, communications infrastructure, and electric vehicle charging and transit stops. Building infrastructure for the public on existing public infrastructure is a simple yet effective solution to meeting our clean energy needs. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Vatran. And we'll go back maybe. I don't know. Did you finish your questions, Representative Swazinski? Do you have some more?
I do, Madam Chair. And just this might be a question that's better conditioned for a different committee potentially. But, you know, one of my fears would be is that when it comes to essentially the state gobbling up right of way, that, you know, if you have a bill or pushing this, you know, my ultimate question is it the author's intention to, you know, push MnDOT to excessively expand the amount of right of way that it says it's in control of, with the idea that it will eliminate local control from local landowners. So essentially, you know, you've got not just right of way, you have state owned assets under the state system, but you also have right-of-way that can potentially expand or limit or encourage development within a certain line. And my fear is that what this bill could potentially lead to is the state gobbling up potential assets, not just for transportation projects, but also transmission projects. And is there a way that you're going to protect local landowners so that they have the right to do on their land as they so choose, or are you going to be putting, you know, the state's interests or the state mandates, not a market-driven system, first?
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Swazinski, the intention of the bill was to leverage existing right-of-way, not expand right-of-way.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you. And then just a question for your constituent, Madam Chair. I forget your name.
Miss, come on back up.
Thank you. And just a quick question, Madam Chair. So I believe in your testimony you stated that under the current language that if a project was built just on the outside of current right-of-way, but that right-of-way changed after that route, the state would no longer be responsible. Did I hear your testimony correctly?
Ms. Marillo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what I was trying to say is that regardless if a project, a transmission project, were to be built after that July 1st, 2024 date, whether or not the utility chose to put it in the existing right-of-way or next to the existing right-of-way, as the language stands, it would not be eligible for reimbursement. I think that is something that, regardless, if we were to keep the relocation reimbursement portion of the bill, we should fix, especially because it's, this bill is really trying to give utilities the option to use these right-of-ways if they feel that that is in the best interest of the company and the consumers. So if we were to keep the relocation provision, which for the record, Clean Grid Alliance is not attached to, we really just want to provide utilities the option and trust the author and the utilities to work that portion out. But that relocation provision, as it is written, transmission lines would no longer be eligible for relocation reimbursement should a highway expand, no matter how far from the highway they currently are.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony. And then I don't know if we do have a transportation chair in the committee. I don't know, would I possibly, would Representative Hornstein, you know, just kind of continue that line of questioning, Madam Chair, Representative Hornstein, kind of along those same lines of looking at kind of the take, the land essentially taking or grabbing or expanding influence on adjoining land. You know, is it your intention at all to potentially allow for the expansion of state sovereignty in certain areas along corridors to make room for utility placement to ease this carbon reduction bill, or is it we're going to try to maintain the status quo when it comes to widths and from center lines and the rest? Does the transportation chair have any vision or thoughts on this particular issue?
He has no vision.
And before I turn it over to our chair of transportation committee, I will just say this bill, when it passes out of here today, we'll go to transportation and we'll get a full hearing there as well. But Chair Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Swazinski. I support the bill, and I think for the reasons that several of the testifiers have alluded to, we need to, we need to be able to increase the capacity for transmission. And so if there are some tweaks that need to be made between, here and the committee, I'm certainly open to those. I'd work with the author and other stakeholders, but I do support the bill.
Okay. Representative Swazinski?
I'll just stop. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. I think Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Representative Kraft, we're going to be, ratepayers in Minnesota are going to be spending billions on transmission in the years ahead. My understanding, the purpose of your bill is just that if we were to allow this, that we're going to be able to spend a little less money on easements on private property. We're going to have a little less eminent domain proceedings so that we're not taking land from private landowners. And we're just going to make it a little bit more affordable for these investments. That it's just we recognize this is going to be an extremely expensive process, and your bill is just a modest attempt to make things just a little less expensive. Is that a fair way to describe it?
And I will maybe just add, save a lot of time, Representative Kraft.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, thank you for the closing summary.
Yeah, okay, all right.
I might say maybe a little bit more than a little, but in certain situations it can be quite impactful, but yeah.
So, and
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Kraft. This cost issue is one you got to figure out. I understand why MnDOT's behaving the way they do, and I understand why the utilities are. Honestly, the biggest concern I have with this bill is that Senator McEwen's the author of it in the Senate, and I don't agree with her on anything. So that's pretty much my biggest concern. But thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Kraft.
Terry,
yes.
Terry, up here, Kayla.
Sorry. I heard the noise. I just couldn't know where it was coming from. Ms. Christensen.
Yes, one thing that didn't get mentioned in anything we've talked about is that in Wisconsin, where this idea came from, more than 200 lines that have been developed along interstate corridors, not one single pole has had to be moved because departments were working together from the beginning and planning this out from the beginning. And so that's the purpose of this policy, is to make sure that we do it right the first time.
That's a great, great comment. Thank you for sharing that. Any closing comments, Representative Kraft?
Madam Chair, So with Representative Garofalo and the last testifier here, I think my closing comments have been made really effectively. And I think the point about wanting, if we can have a structure we set up where the utilities and MnDOT can be planning and talking about this, will eliminate a lot of the cost questions. So great. Thank you all, and please support the bill.
With that, Representative Kraft renews his motion that House File 3900, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Transportation. Any discussion to the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to transportation. And we meet again tomorrow at same time. See you then. Thanks. This meeting is adjourned.